Today we begin our series on the book of Romans, which might be the most important book of the Bible. It'd be a very hard call to say which book is the most important, because different books make different contributions to what we know about the mind of God. I would say the book of Romans, more than most books of the Bible, gives a greater variety of essential information than most of the books do. Although even that is hard to say. It is one of the longer epistles of Paul. There are very few of Paul's epistles that are very long. Most of them are short documents. But there's no wasted words in Romans. At least not in the first 15 chapters. And in the 16th chapter, we have largely a chapter devoted to Paul's personal greetings to friends and people he knows in Rome. But even there, we have spiritual light given to us. And we will look at the book of Romans more carefully than we have some of the books that we've gone through. That is, we will dwell on each passage more carefully and seek to make sure that we do not lose any of the nuggets that are delivered to our hands here. The book of Romans is the book that Martin Luther was reading when he got saved. And when he discovered that justification is not by Catholic ritual. He was a monk in the Catholic Church. He was an Augustinian monk and a teacher in a Roman Catholic college. And as he studied for his lectures on Romans, he discovered the truth of justification by faith, which has come to be the foundational doctrine that it distinguishes between those who are Protestant and those who are Roman Catholic. And it was this discovery that really changed the world in many ways. And whatever we may think about Luther's doctrines on other things, or even him as a man, he had many personal flaws in his character. Yet we cannot deny that he was the instrument of God's choice to shake up permanently the monopoly over the souls of men in Europe that the Roman Catholic Church had had. There were others before Luther who tried to start alternative movements, and they were captured and burned, and their movements often came to almost nothing. But through Luther, God rattled that cage, and the doors opened, and those doors have never been shut. The freedom to follow Jesus Christ according to conscience was that which Luther affirmed and stood for, and somehow managed to survive in spite of doing so, and to launch much of the spiritual reality that or the awareness of it that we take for granted every day. If you are an evangelical, and I think everyone in this room is, then you are aware that we are justified by faith, not by works. But the ramifications of this doctrine, both in conduct and in attitude toward law and toward grace, are nowhere defined for us better than in the book of Romans. Now, there's another book in the Bible that's very much like Romans in content, and that is the book of Galatians. Paul wrote Galatians probably earlier than Romans. There's no one who could say for certain when Galatians was written, and there's really two camps on that. There are those who hold to the what's called the South Galatian theory and those who hold the North Galatian theory, because the term Galatia is ambiguous, and in some usages it refers to the southern region of this area called Galatia, where Paul evangelized in his first missionary journey. And in other usages, it takes in a larger provincial northern area. And so when Paul writes the churches of Galatia, scholars are not certain whether he's speaking of South Galatia, which he evangelized on his first missionary journey. And if so, then probably Galatians was a very early epistle, perhaps the earliest one Paul wrote. Or if Paul is referring to North Galatia, which we have no record of him evangelizing, and if he did it at all, it must have been late in his life, and therefore the book would have been written late. I will just say that scholars are not agreed about this, and scholars better than myself would disagree with my conclusion, but scholars better than myself would agree with it too. There are good scholars on both sides, but I believe the evidence on balance supports the idea that Galatians was written early and much earlier than Romans. That Romans was probably written as much as 7 or 8 years later than Galatians, but on the same topics. And there are differences as well as similarities between Galatians and Romans. Both of them have the same theme, and that is the gospel versus the law as a means of relating to God and being saved. Certainly both books emphasize the fact that we are justified by faith or by grace through faith, although that statement is found in Ephesians that I just alluded to, but that's the message of Galatians and of Romans, and that the law is a much misunderstood feature of God's plan, which the Jews have typically believed is the means of salvation. But Paul says, no, the law had an entirely different function than that, and it is a huge mistake to look to the law as a means of justification. And when Paul wrote Galatians, he wrote it in a very different state of mind than when he wrote Romans. You can tell when you read Galatians that Paul is agitated. He uses sarcasm. He uses biting criticisms of the false teachers who are trying to bring the Galatian converts under the law. He is angry. And his anger shows in his choice of words and phrases. And it's obvious that he wrote Galatians in a heated spirit. But when you read the book of Romans, there's nothing of that heated spirit. He's calm. He is logical. He is developing an argument from the earliest premises to the necessary conclusions with a seamless logic, so seamless, in fact, that as I understand it, many secular universities, when teaching philosophy students in their classes on formal logic, have used the book of Romans as an example of perfect logic. Certainly not a book that gives any evidence of having been written in an emotional frenzy. And yet you'll find so many parallels in the actual material or thoughts in Romans and Galatians that one could almost argue that Galatians was a rough draft of the book of Romans. Not so much that Paul wrote Galatians planning to write Romans and figured that Galatians was a rough draft, but that's how it turned out to be, that Paul enunciated his ideas on these themes first when writing to the Galatians. And years later, as these same thoughts had rolled over in his mind, he found new ways to express them or to illustrate them. He later wrote out more in treatise fashion the book of Romans. Now, the reason for the heated nature of his letter to Galatians and the absence of such emotion in Romans is apparently that the Galatians, first of all, were Paul's own children in the faith. Paul had converted them. They were his offspring. He had parental instinctive protectiveness toward them, and when he saw them getting into error, it angered him, just like it would anger a mother to see someone trying to kidnap her child. And Paul said to the Galatians, "My little children, in whom I travail again in childbirth until Christ be formed in you." He had this motherly instinct toward them. Romans, Paul had never been to Rome. He'd never seen Rome, never seen these people. There were some friends of his who were there, and he greeted them by name in the last chapter, but they were not, he had not known them by his visit to Rome. But these were no doubt people who traveled throughout the empire with Rome as a hub and had encountered Paul in other places. But the church in Rome was a church of strangers to Paul. And while he obviously had concern for them on his heart, he didn't know them personally and did not have quite the same connection with them that he had with the Galatians, which partly explains the emotion in his writing to Galatia and the lack thereof in his writing to Rome. It is also the case that when he wrote to the Galatians, the church was in crisis there. The church was under attack from outside heretical influences, and Paul was like a protective parent coming to the rescue of a child. When he wrote to the Romans, we don't have any reason to believe there was a great crisis in the church. Now, there probably was a problem that he was addressing in the book of Romans, and that is not recognized by all scholars, and it may not be true, but there is some controversy as to whether Romans is, like other epistles, an occasional document. That is, whether it was written to suit the needs of a particular occasion, or whether it was just Paul writing a treatise on the subject of salvation that he could have written any time to anyone and just happened to send it on to Rome because he planned to go there himself and wanted to kind of precede himself, sort of sort of grease the skids for him by sending a letter ahead and letting him know what he's going to be preaching about and what his positions are. Sort of like sending a statement of faith or something on ahead of him before he visits the church. I personally think it is an occasional document. I do believe that it was addressing a problem in Rome, but the problem in Rome was not anything like the crisis in Galatia, so that we don't have, again, the same emotion and heat in Paul's presentation, or urgency even, in Romans that you find in the book of Galatians. So there are very close similarities to Galatians. As we study through Romans, we'll have occasion to look over at Galatians and see that Paul said the very same thing, shorter in Galatians, that he says sometimes in a whole chapter in Romans. Sometimes he'll give, you know, half a chapter in Romans to something that was in a single verse in Galatians. But the tone is very different. In fact, Galatians is extremely personal because Paul knows the people and they're friends of his, and because he made great sacrifices to bring them to Christ. Romans is the most impersonal letter Paul wrote, with the possible exception of Ephesians. Ephesians is very impersonal also. But Romans is 100% impersonal, with the exception of a few words of greeting at the beginning and the last chapter, chapter 16, where Paul actually does send greetings to people he knows and says hello to so-and-so and to so-and-so. And that, if you would remove chapter 16 from it, you'd have nothing very personal at all in the whole epistle. It's mainly a theological discourse, which is very different than most of Paul's epistles. Now, when it comes to the purpose of the epistle, as I said, there's different opinions. As we go through it, I will seek to develop my own thoughts on this, my own opinion about why Paul wrote it, but it may not be all that important to decide this. The teaching of Romans stands alone with or without an understanding of its background as far as what may have been going on in the church. It is generally said, most commentators would say, that Romans is written as a theological treatise and not as an address to any particular problems in the church. But I think that if a suggestion is made that there may have been some tension in the Church of Rome, a bit of disunity between the two factions, namely the Jew and the Gentile elements in the church, one can see much evidence of this reading in the book of Romans. Now, it's easy to read through the book of Romans and not pick this up very much. But if the suggestion is first introduced, it is one of those things that you can begin to see many clues throughout the book. And one thing is clear. The church, though it was in a Gentile land, I mean, Rome was the capital not only of Italy, but of the whole Roman Empire, the Gentile world, we can certainly deduce that the church was primarily a Gentile church, yet it had a significant Jewish element within it, which is unmistakable from the fact that Paul devotes several whole chapters addressing the Jews. And some chapters he addresses specifically the Gentiles. I mean, in chapter 2, for example, verse 17, he says, "Indeed, you are called a Jew." He's obviously speaking to persons in the church who are Jewish. And there is much of what he has to say in the early chapters that is directed to those particular people in the church. Whereas, and also, by the way, in Romans 4:1, what shall we say then, that Abraham our father has found according to the flesh? That is, our father according to the flesh means our earthly ancestor. He's obviously referring to Jewish people when he says our father according to the flesh, Abraham. Now, if he just said our father, even Gentiles can look to Abraham as our father, because he used to be the father of many nations. And in terms of faith, he is the father of all those who have faith. But Paul, when he specifies our father according to the flesh, he is obviously speaking of the mutual ethnicity that he shares with the Jewish element in the church that he's addressing. But later, in Romans chapter 11, Paul very clearly speaks to Gentiles in the church. In Romans 11:13, for example, he says, "For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry." Now, it is because Paul was an apostle to the Gentiles that he took it on himself to meddle in the affairs of the Church of Rome. Paul did not, as far as we know, ever write a letter to the church in Jerusalem and correct them for their legalism or for their passion for the law. This may be because Paul was not offended by Jewish Christians keeping the law. He didn't like at all when people tried to put Gentile Christians under the law. Or it may be that though Paul did not agree with the policy of the Jewish church in Jerusalem of keeping the law, as we know they did, whether he agreed with it or not, he may have felt that's not his turf. You know, he's an apostle to the uncircumcised. Peter and James and John, those pillars, were the ones who were the apostles to the circumcised, and that was their business. Now, the Church of Rome might have been considered none of Paul's business, since he had never been there. He did not found that church. He was not their spiritual father. But he makes it very clear in the first chapter that he feels an obligation and a debt to them because he is the apostle to the Gentiles that God chose, and because they were, apparently as a church, predominantly Gentile. And Rome was obviously a Gentile city, clearly in Paul's province of ministry. And so we have a church here that's got, it's probably mainly Gentiles, but it has a significant element of Jews, and it would appear that there was some tension between these two. Paul never comes right out and says that the church is experiencing this tension, but the things that Paul says when he addresses the Jews, in chapter 2, for example, is addressing their bigotry against Gentiles and their assumption that because they keep the law, they are, or even because they have the law, whether they keep it or not, because they are the people of the law, that they are better than Gentiles. And of course, he corrects that in chapters 2 and 3. And the fact that he feels the need to correct that may imply that he's addressing an actual attitude that existed in the Jewish portion of the church. Later in chapter 11, he speaks to the Gentiles and tells them not to be haughty against the Jews, against those branches that were broken off in order that they, the Gentile branches, could be grafted in. He says, don't be so haughty about this. Don't be arrogant, because you could be cut off too. And his saying that may indicate that the Gentiles had a bit of bigotry against the Jews. They're feeling kind of arrogant because they felt like the Jews were all bound up in legalism and they were weak in faith and so forth. And Paul, in chapter 14 and 15, does acknowledge that there were some in the church who were weak in faith. And if you read those chapters, you'll see that the ones that he calls weak in faith are the ones who limited their eating to certain foods and who kept special days as sacred. Whereas there was another element in the church who did not limit their diet and who did not keep special sacred days. Now, while Paul does not tell us that the ones who were weak in faith, who limited their diet and kept special days, he doesn't tell us they were Jews. And he doesn't tell us that the other group were Gentiles. Yet, it would appear, most likely, that the Jewish people in the church were the ones most likely to continue observing Jewish dietary restrictions and keeping Sabbath and things like that. I mean, that was something they were raised doing before they were Christians. And in many cases, they didn't see any reason to stop doing it after they became Christians. It's like if you were raised eating food from one culture, and you developed a taste for it, and then when you became a Christian, you began to associate with people of another culture, but you didn't like their food, you might still choose in your home to eat the food you were raised with, even though you have the liberty to do something else. I mean, the Jews had grown up eating kosher, and the eating of certain things offended their sensitivities. And Paul, actually, in Romans 14, does not rebuke them for that. He basically just says, don't judge those who don't do what you're doing. And he addresses those who aren't so observant of these kinds of regulations. And he says, now, don't you despise those who are eating only vegetables and who keep a sacred day and so forth. Yeah, the Jews, it's hard for them to break free from some of those sensitivities, and some of those sensitivities don't need to be broken free from necessarily, as long as they don't interpret those things as means of righteousness. Then let them do it. Let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. And this discussion in Romans 14 sounds to me as if he's trying to bring some kind of reconciliation in a tense relationship between the Jewish and the Gentile portion of the church. Now, these are just the larger evidences. There are many smaller evidences, just phrases that Paul will throw in here and there, and I'll observe them as we comment through the book, that kind of add to this impression that Paul is speaking into a church where there is racial tension. And it's not racial tension because of racism, it's because of religious differences. It's because of differences in religious sensitivities and different conscience that different Christians have. So I'm going to suggest that Paul wrote Romans for two reasons. One is because there was a situation in the church he wished to address. There was a division there. And another is because Paul is fully intending to come soon to Rome, as we shall see. He states his intentions. And he wanted to precede himself with this letter. He wanted to acquaint them with the gospel that they will hear from him when he comes. As I say, it's a little bit like a person sending who's going to be speaking somewhere he's never been before, sending forward his statement of faith so that they might not be surprised by anything that he believes or says when he comes. Now, in the notes I've given you, there's just some information there about the city of Rome. I mean, every epistle that was addressed to a church was addressed to a church in some geographical area. And it doesn't hurt for us to know something about that area, because a lot of times the features of the geography or of the politics of a region have some impact on the state of the church as well. The city of Rome, for many years before the time of Christ, at least 70, had been the capital of a huge empire. It had inherited the empire that had belonged to Alexander and his successors, the Grecian Empire. Alexander had in turn conquered the Persian Empire before his, and the Persians had conquered the Babylonian. And the borders of these empires were not exactly coextensive. They were not precisely the same. But in general, the Mediterranean world and the Middle East and Western Europe had, for the most part, been under these various powers. Rome was the largest empire of all of those, the most powerful. When Daniel had talked about these four empires, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, and the Roman, and he had described them as different kinds of beasts, and the Roman Empire in his vision in Daniel 7 was a fierce beast having 10 horns and iron claws or iron teeth. A ferocious kind of a thing. Rome was a very powerful empire. It actually lasted for the better part of 1,000 years in one form or another. It existed for several hundred years before it conquered the whole world around it. And then once it did, it stood for another 500 or more years after the time of Christ. In fact, in some respects, it continues to this day. Or it did continue for a very long time in the Eastern Empire. So Rome was a unique empire in history. Stronger, larger, more enduring than most. Rome commanded an area that included parts of North Africa and extended west as far as the British Isles, about as far west as you can go before you get to America or Canada, and as far east as the Arabian lands, which of course included Palestine too. And so Jesus and the apostles all lived under the reign of the emperor in Rome. And it was therefore, as the capital of such a large empire, a strategic beachhead, a strategic dissemination point for ideas throughout the empire. People, all roads led to Rome. And people who traveled almost always traveled at least once to Rome, and many people traveled regularly between Rome and other parts of the empire. And because of that, ideas that became popular in Rome were easily disseminated through the whole civilized world, whether good ideas or bad. And we know that there were as many bad versions of the gospel going around, as many perversions and heretical things going around, as to give the apostle plenty to do to keep setting the record straight. I mean, whether it was in Colossians addressing the Colossian heresy, or Galatians addressing the Judaizing heresy, or whether it was in some other place where there's going to be a problem with antinomianism or Gnosticism. There were heresies disseminated. And Paul no doubt believed that if he could get the gospel squared away, the authentic gospel, in Rome, if the church in Rome could become a bastion of truth in a world of heretical things flying around the empire, that from Rome the truth could spread like spokes radiating from the hub of a wheel to the other parts of the empire. Now, Paul, of course, had already done a lot of work in the other parts of the empire and had already established the gospel there. But Rome would be a particularly strategic beachhead to establish for the gospel, and I'm not saying that Rome didn't already know the gospel, truly. We don't know how the church in Rome got started. It was planted by somebody prior to the year 50 AD, although none of the apostles are known to have been there that early. Paul wasn't even saved. Well, I shouldn't say. He was saved. He wasn't involved in ministry, I should say, until almost that time. He made his first missionary journey probably around 49 AD. And we know he didn't go to Rome. So Paul didn't establish the church in Rome. The Roman Catholic Church has the tradition that Peter established the church in Rome, but that doesn't appear to be correct biblically. Certainly the Bible does not tell us that Peter established the church in Rome, and we know that Peter was at the Jerusalem Council in the year 50 AD in Jerusalem, and that there was a church in Rome prior to that time. Now, if Peter had established the church in Rome, he must have gone to Rome and perhaps returned to Jerusalem for the Jerusalem Council, which is not impossible to imagine. But there's certainly no indication that Peter had gone very far from Jerusalem, even by the year 50 AD. Certainly nothing to indicate he'd been as far away as Rome. The more respectable Protestant theories about how the church in Rome got started are, well, there's more than one theory. Some people believe that it was started as the result of people, Jews, who had come from Rome to Jerusalem and were there on the day of Pentecost and heard Peter preach and were among those that were converted. We do read in Acts chapter 2 that on the day of Pentecost there were people there from Rome, that is, Jewish pilgrims from Rome, coming to celebrate the feast in Jerusalem. And among the 3,000 that were converted that day, and perhaps the 5,000 that were converted within the next few days or weeks after that, many of them could have been some of these pilgrims from Rome, and eventually they'd have to go home and return to their homes and their businesses and so forth. And it's not at all unlikely that some of the people who got saved on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem returned to their home in Rome, and of course, what could they do but live and talk about their new faith? And that could mean that the church in Rome was established just by this kind of activity, informally, without an official evangelist or apostle going there. It seems clear that the church was a home-based organism in Rome. I'll point out in a few minutes that there are evidences in the 16th chapter that the church didn't have any kind of a building they met in, but they tended to meet in various homes of members of the congregation. And that may be because the church started out kind of organically there. It may be that Christians went back to their homes in Rome from Jerusalem, began to talk to their neighbors, began to invite their neighbors over, began to meet with them in their homes, and who knows? That could be how the church got started in Rome. There are other theories. We do know that in Acts chapter 8, when Stephen had been stoned and persecution broke out in Jerusalem, it says that the saints there who had been confined geographically to Jerusalem up to that point were now scattered everywhere throughout the empire, and they preached the gospel wherever they went. So it is not an impossible suggestion that some of these Christians from Jerusalem, when scattered by this persecution, may have gone to Rome and may have preached the gospel there, and the church could have come about by that means. It's also not impossible to suggest a theory of the Church of Antioch or some other church that was interested in Gentile missions. We know the Church of Antioch was. In fact, it's the only church we really know much about sending out missionaries to the Gentiles. That they may have sent out a team. We know that they sent Paul and Barnabas out on their first missionary journey, although not to Rome. The church may have sent out other teams to Gentile lands unbeknownst to us. There's very little recorded. And one of these teams could have gone to Rome. Any of those theories could be true, and maybe a combination of them would explain it. But we do know that prior to 50 AD there was a church in Rome, because there was something recorded in the historian, I believe it was Tacitus, the Roman historian, or it may have been Suetonius, but I believe it was Tacitus, who mentions that the Emperor Claudius, in the year 49 or 50 AD, banished all Jews from the city of Rome because of contentions and apparently riots and problems that arose over Crestus, the historian says. Now, Crestus, almost all scholars believe that Crestus is a mistaken form for the name Christus. The Roman historian, not knowing, you know, how it was spelled and having heard it, didn't understand the pronunciation correctly, but Christus is the Latin form for Christ. And so it is believed by historians as they read these Roman records that Claudius, the emperor of Rome, banished all the Jews from Rome because of problems and dissensions that were raised there regarding Christ, which suggests, of course, that the name of Christ had reached Rome, information about Christ had reached Rome, and in all likelihood, the dissensions that are referred to are those dissensions that arose when certain people began to embrace the doctrine of Christ and the Jews persecuted them. We read much in the book of Acts of Paul going to Gentile lands, bringing the gospel there, and the Jews there persecuting them and driving them out. This is a pattern in Paul's life, and there's no reason to doubt that the same thing happened in Rome, without Paul being present. We do know from Acts chapter 18 that Priscilla and Aquila were Jewish people from Rome who were driven out of Rome by this very decree of Claudius, and they immigrated to Corinth in Greece, and they happened to encounter Paul for the first time there when he came to Corinth, and he worked with them as a tent maker and lived with them, and eventually they traveled with him and were companions with him. They went to Ephesus, and eventually, when Claudius was dead and the Jews were allowed to return to Rome, Priscilla and Aquila went back to Rome, and that's where they were when Paul wrote this letter, because he sends them greetings back there in Rome in Romans chapter 16. So we know that Claudius, apparently because of conflicts over the gospel in Rome, banished the Jews from Rome in 49 or 50 A.D., and that means the gospel must have reached there by then. And that's prior to the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, where the apostles were still in Jerusalem, apparently, or again in Jerusalem. And so it would appear the apostles were not instrumental in the founding of the Church of Rome, but rather ordinary Christians, what we call laymen, just doing personal evangelism in all likelihood, whether it was pilgrims who'd come back from Pentecost to Rome, or whether it was scattered Jewish Christians who had, because of the persecution in Jerusalem, had gone there, we don't know. But there was a church there, and Paul was concerned about it because he was the apostle to the Gentiles, and this was a Gentile region and within his jurisdiction as an apostle. I mentioned that there's evidence that the church was based in homes rather than in any kind of a church buildings. If you turn to Romans chapter 16, you'll see the evidence I'm alluding to here. In Romans 16, verses 3 through 5, Paul says, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus." Now, obviously, he's writing to people who are in Rome, telling them to greet Priscilla and Aquila. Obviously, Priscilla and Aquila are there in Rome, who risked their own necks for my life. We don't read in the book of Acts of them doing this, but there's much that is not recorded. There must have been times when Paul's life was spared by them at their own personal risk. "To whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles." It's not exactly clear why all the churches of the Gentiles are obliged or indebted to Priscilla and Aquila. Maybe because they spared Paul's life and he's a minister to all the churches of the Gentiles, and all the churches of the Gentiles can thank them for that, because he'd be dead if not for what they had done. Or maybe they may have traveled a great deal too, unrecorded in the book of Acts, and traveled and ministered in the churches of the Gentiles themselves. In any case, in verse 5 he says of them, "Likewise greet the church that is in their house." So we know that the church, or part of the church, met in the house of Priscilla and Aquila. But perhaps not the whole church. Rome was a big city, and there's reason to believe that there would be a lot of believers there, that the church would be somewhat larger than would be comfortably housed in the house of any single family, any individual family. And there may be implication in some of the things Paul says later in Romans 16 that there were some other households that hosted church meetings besides Priscilla and Aquila's. In verse 10, he says, greet Apelles, approved of Christ, greet those who are of the household of Aristobulus. And in verse 11, he says, greet Herodion, my kinsman, greet those who are of the household of Narcissus, who are in the Lord. Now, the word household is not found in the Greek. That's why it's in italics. But some word is implied there in the Greek. It says those who are of Aristobulus, those who are of Narcissus. And by the translators supplying the word household, they're probably not very far from what Paul was implying. There is the possibility that there are groups of Christians in meeting in different homes. There were those who were in the home of Priscilla and Aquila. There were some who were in the household of Aristobulus and some in the household of Narcissus. At least this is a distinct possibility. Also in verse 14, Paul says, greet Asyncritus, Phlegon, Hermas, Petrobus, Hermes, and the brethren who are with them. And then the next verse, 15, says, greet Philologus and Julia and Nereus and his sister and Olympus and all the saints who are with them. Now notice, he talks about different groups and the saints who are with them, and then this group and the saints who are with them. It seems like the saints were meeting in different groups, different homes. And this should not be construed to mean that there were different denominations in Rome, in the Church of Rome. This would not be the case. Paul would not tolerate this. We know from the way he wrote to the Corinthians that he would see that as an abomination, because Christ is not divided. I think what we are best, safest in assuming is that the church in Rome was one church, as the church in every town is one church. But because of its size, it could not, you know, congregate all at one time in one place. And therefore, there were perhaps fellowship centers in various homes. And although they would meet in different places, they were no doubt considered to be one body, one church, not several denominations. And we don't know anything about the structure of the church in terms of its leadership or anything, but we can see that Paul expected that his letter would be read by all of them. It's not as if there was some kind of independence of these groups so that one would receive his letter and the others might not see it, as would be the case, for example, if a missionary sent a letter to one of the churches in McMinnville. Well, that church would see it, but probably none of the other churches would, because there's no relationship. But Paul knew that when he sent his letter to the saints in Rome, all the saints in Rome, wherever they happen to be meeting, were going to get a chance to read it, because the churches shared their spiritual resources with each other. There was really only one church, but there were churches in the sense of congregations or gatherings in various places. The parallel to that in our modern time, I think, it would necessitate that we see the church, for example, in McMinnville, which probably has, I've never counted them, I would guess there's at least 50 or more congregations in McMinnville. We call them churches, we call them denominations, we call them different things, but they're basically just gatherings of Christians. However we may call them or view them, however they may even organize themselves or view their own organization, in the sight of God, I suspect that he just looks down and sees so many different meeting places of the church. There's one church here, and Christians in that one church meet in various places. And that's how it apparently was in Rome, in the Church of Rome there. Now, the Christians in Rome may have experienced tension with the government at times. We know that Paul had to write to them in chapter 13 of Romans and tell them not to be rebellious against the government and to keep the laws. And perhaps they were not doing so, or maybe he just gave that as universal instructions for good measure. But we know that they were the followers of a man named Jesus, and there were records in the Roman courts that this man had been condemned by a Roman court as a criminal. I mean, it's not as if he was just some guy who fell among the Jews and was stoned to death and the Romans wouldn't have ever paid any attention to him. He actually was condemned officially by a Roman court, by Pontius Pilate, who would have sent records back to Rome. In fact, one of the early church fathers, I think it was Justin Martyr, in one of his epistles to somebody, to Trypho or someone, he mentioned that Jesus had been crucified under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and he says, as the records clearly show that are found in Rome, the court records show this, he said. Now, we don't know whether Justin was personally acquainted with those records or whether he just assumed, since it was a historical fact and it would be Roman procedure, that a copy of the court proceedings were sent to Rome. But Justin spoke quite confidently that there were records of this in Rome, of what had happened to Jesus. And that being so, in the city of Rome, when a group of people begin to rise up and have distinctive meeting places and they're outwardly preaching to the public, and when people begin to listen to what they're saying, they sound like they're advocating worship of this person, Jesus of Nazareth. And yet we have record here that he was an opponent of Rome. That's what he was condemned for. That he was no friend of Caesar. That he claimed to be the king of the Jews, which is Caesar's title. And you can see that the Christians were up against a pretty stiff challenge there right from the beginning, right there in the imperial city where Caesar lived, that they were preaching that men ought to submit to and believe in and follow and worship this man that, as far as Rome is concerned, just a criminal who had opposed Caesar. And you can imagine that would not make Christianity settle well with loyal Romans. And I'm sure that there were times when it was tense, if not outright conflicts with the state. I already mentioned that Claudius, one of the emperors, had made his decree that Jews must leave Rome. It doesn't say he made the Christians leave Rome, but it was because of conflicts over Christ. It may well be that Claudius recognized that the conflicts were about Christ, but they were instigated by the Jews. Or it may also be that Claudius, like many of the Roman political officials of the time, and we read of this in the book of Acts, in the case, for example, of I think it was in Corinth. Yeah, it was in Corinth that the Jews brought Paul's companions before the tribunal there, the Roman procurator or judge, and tried to persuade him to kick them out of Corinth, and he couldn't see the difference between Christians and Jews. I mean, everybody except Christians and Jews believed in many gods. The Romans believed in many gods. The Jews, for a long time, were the only people who ever said, no, there's only one God. And now the Christians, who also said the same thing, were around, and most of their preachers were Jewish, and they're talking about this Jewish guy named Jesus. The Romans, they couldn't perceive there's any difference. They just thought Christianity was another sect of Judaism. So it's possible that when Claudius learned of the strife between the Christians and the Jews in his domain, that he just saw it as an intramural spat among sects of Judaism, and so that when he banished all Jews, he thought maybe he's getting rid of everybody that's involved in this whole controversy. But in any case, we know that problems arising over the gospel had come to the attention of the emperor Claudius and had even led him to take fairly drastic action, banishing all Jewish people from the city for a period of time. As I mentioned, Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, it gives specific instructions that the Christians should show proper respect to duly appointed authority, even to the emperor and his agents. And these instructions might well have been given because of Paul's awareness that Christians were not showing adequate respect for authority. And there may have been some of the conflicts I'm suggesting. At a later time, Peter was martyred in Rome, and so was Paul. And so were many others. And so we know that the relations between the Roman church and the Roman government were not always cordial. Now, the time that Paul wrote this letter was apparently in the winter of the years spanning 57 and 58 A.D., about 7 years after the Jerusalem Council. We know this because you can work out the chronology of Paul's travels from the book of Acts. And Paul was, at the time he wrote it, traveling. He was at the end of his third missionary journey. He was on his way to Jerusalem. His trip to Jerusalem was partly to observe a feast and partly to deliver a gift, because Paul, in his labors among the Gentiles, had been mindful of a couple of things. One was that there were great financial needs in the church in Jerusalem, which was not his province. He didn't work the church in Jerusalem. That was beyond his sphere. But he was aware that the church in Jerusalem had been hit hard by economic pressure and that there was a lot of poverty there among the Christians in Jerusalem. He was also aware there was a great deal of tension between the church of Jerusalem and his own self, because the Christians in Jerusalem were very zealous for the law. And they heard rumors about him, that he was even teaching Jews not to circumcise their children and not to keep the law of Moses. Now, we don't know whether Paul was ever teaching Jews that or not. We know he taught that to Gentiles. He may have taught it to Jews, we don't know, but they had heard that he had taught these things to Jews, and that made them very upset. The Jewish Christians in Jerusalem tended to feel that Paul might not be on the same team with them, that he might be running a rival operation, a rival movement, maybe even a different gospel. Now, the officials in Jerusalem had endorsed Paul. Paul, knowing of this tension, had gone to Jerusalem more than once and met with the apostles, and on one occasion that he describes in the second chapter of Galatians, they recognized his genuine apostleship to the Gentiles, and they gave him the right hand of fellowship, which suggests an acknowledgement of partnership in the gospel. And that he and Barnabas would go to the Gentiles, and Peter, James, and John would go to the circumcised. And that was an official recognition. But notwithstanding the official recognition proffered by Peter, James, and John, at a later time when Peter was not prominent in Jerusalem, and James was, and James much more zealous for the law than Peter apparently was, there was still kind of ill will, a general feeling of suspicion on the part of the Jewish Christians toward Paul. And Paul knew this. And one of the reasons he was taking a gift to the church in Jerusalem was because, A, he knew they needed it, and B, he hoped it might sort of pour some oil on the waters, as it were, and bring a bit of calm and reconciliation and allay the suspicions and so forth, and to try to establish, by a token of generosity from the Gentile churches, a gift to the poor in Jerusalem, that there was one body here, that there was not really a rival movement going on, that the concerns and the needs of the Jewish church were also burdens that the Gentile churches were willing to help to bear. And so Paul had, on both his second and third missionary journey, gone about through his own churches in the Gentile regions and asked them to contribute. We see, for example, in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, two chapters devoted to asking the Corinthians to make a contribution for this, for the church in Jerusalem. And now, at the time he wrote this, he was on his way to Jerusalem at the end of his third missionary journey, and he was bringing the gift to Jerusalem. But he did not intend to stay there long. His trip to Jerusalem was a goodwill mission, and partly due to the fact he wanted to be there for the feast, for whatever reasons we don't know. But he intended fully to leave Jerusalem shortly after arriving there, leaving behind, he hoped, feelings of goodwill on the part of the Jewish church. And then he was setting his sights towards Spain. He wanted to go to Spain because he knew the gospel had not yet been preached there. And he figured he'd drop by Rome on the way there. If you know the geography of the Mediterranean, when you're going from Jerusalem to Spain, Rome is right on the way there. So Paul's intention when he wrote this was to make a quick trip to Jerusalem and then set sail for Spain and pay a visit to the Roman church. Now, he tells them as much. He tells them that he's on his way to Jerusalem. He tells them that he's hoping to go to Spain and that he's hoping to visit them on the way. He gives the impression that he may see them soon. Now, Paul, when he wrote this, didn't know how things were going to materialize. We know from the book of Acts that he actually did go to Jerusalem, but he did not, at least not immediately, go to Spain or Rome. Because when he was in Jerusalem, he was falsely accused by the Jews there of desecrating the temple, and they started a riot, and the Romans had to intervene and take Paul out of the hands of the Jewish mob and take him into protective custody. And the Jews raised a great deal of confusion as to what Paul was guilty of. The Romans didn't understand the issues and weren't quite sure what to do with Paul. And as they were trying to deliberate about this, they kept him in protective custody and basically in jail for 2 years
in Caesarea. So here he was hoping to just visit Jerusalem briefly and go on to Rome and then to Spain, but he ended up going to Jerusalem and getting stuck at that end of the Mediterranean in Caesarea, which was the Jewish capital of Israel was Jerusalem, but the Roman capital was Caesarea. And he was stuck in jail there for 2 years, and he might have been there longer, but that the Jews made a bid to have Paul released to their custody so that they could try him, more properly that they could kill him. And he knew their plot, and so he invoked his privilege as a Roman citizen. He appealed his case to Caesar. And this meant that the Roman courts had to honor his request as a citizen to have his case heard before the highest court, that is that of Caesar himself. And at government expense, he was shipped off to Rome. But even then, he didn't get there immediately, because on the way to Rome, the ship sunk. And he ended up having to winter in Malta, and only later when the spring came, he arrived on foot, in chains, to Rome, where he remained a prisoner until the closing of the book of Acts for another 2 years. But as it turned out, Paul, when he wrote this, thought that he might soon see the Romans, and he expected to see them as a free man on his way to traveling further west to see the people in Spain and evangelize them. Instead, what actually transpired was he did come to Rome, but not until 3 years later, after 2 years imprisoned in Caesarea, after a shipwreck, after wintering in Malta, and finally arriving in Rome in chains, and that's how he finally came to Rome. So he was not mistaken in that he believed he would go to Rome, but he was mistaken in terms of timing and the circumstances of it. And it's rather poignant, really, reading in this epistle, knowing that he wrote this when he was ignorant of those developments. He didn't know how things would wash. And here's what he explains in Romans 15. In Romans 15, he says in verse 24, "Whenever I journey to Spain, I shall come to you. For I hope to see you on my journey and to be helped on my way there by you, if first I may enjoy your company for a while. But now I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints," meaning to bring the gift to the Christians there. "For it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia," that's Greece, "to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem. It pleased them indeed, and they are their debtors. For if the Gentiles have been partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister to them in material things. Therefore, when I have performed this and have sealed to them this fruit, I shall go by way of you to Spain." And he says, "But I know that when I come to you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of the gospel of Christ." Now, no doubt that is true. When he did come to them, he came in the fullness of the blessing of the gospel of Christ, but he also came in chains, which was not exactly what he had in mind when he wrote this. Anyway, that explains the timing, the circumstances in Paul's life of the epistle. This was, as I say, the winter time of the year 57-58 A.D. Let's go ahead and look at something else here on your notes. I have given you in the notes an outline of the book of Romans. I won't go over that in detail right now, except to just observe that there are essentially three major divisions of the book, apart from the, you know, the opening greetings and the closing greetings. Those are not included in the main body of the book. When the actual body of argument begins in the book of Romans, there are three segments. Like all the epistles, or like so many of the epistles of Paul, there are two major segments. There's the theological portion and the practical portion. I mean, before we talk about three segments, we can maybe look at the somewhat larger division of two segments. The first 11 chapters in Romans are theological. They lay out his theological case. Now, these 11 chapters are divisible into two different sections. That's what we'll point out in a moment. But as Ephesians and Colossians begin with theological exposition and then proceed to practical application, so does the book of Romans. The difference being that both Colossians and Ephesians give fully half of each of those books to theology and half to practical instruction, whereas Romans gives the vast majority of its chapters to the topics of theology. His theological discussion is in the first 11 chapters. And only in chapters 12 through 15 do we have the second part, which is the practical application. Now, it's not clear exactly why it is that he gave disproportionate amount of space to theology in Romans as compared to his other epistles. In his other epistles, we get the impression that he thought that theology and practical Christian living are about equally important and devote about equal amount of time to both, but certainly not in Romans. This may not be because of any disparity in his view of the value of theology as opposed to practical living. It may be that he felt like the church in Rome had more of a need for theological correction than for exhortation to holy living. Or it may even be that Paul got carried away in the first part. Maybe he intended to give about equal treatment to both parts, but he used up too much of his parchment when he got carried away talking about theology. And when he finally got around to closing that section, he realized he had only a few pages left. And so he condensed it, and he certainly did condense it, because in a chapter like Romans 12, where he begins to do that, we find several short exhortations that are packed. In other words, he's concise, much more concise than he might otherwise be. And it may be that he just found himself running out of room, and that all the things he wanted to say, he had to say more briefly, had to be, not so wordy when he got to the other portion, because he simply was running out of parchment. That's a realistic possibility. In any case, we can observe that there is the theological discussion at the beginning for the first 11 chapters, then the practical application beginning at chapter 12, verse 1. Then, the other division that I wanted to observe, which makes Romans really in three parts, is that the theological section has two major sections. And even these can be subdivided into smaller bits, but the first eight chapters are generally recognized as the most thorough presentation of the gospel in all of the scriptures. The gospel message is laid out logically, thoroughly, anticipating objections and answering them completely in the first eight chapters. So that when you reach the end of chapter eight, you feel you've reached a certain conclusion to the matter. You can tell by the time you've gotten to chapter 8, you've read chapter after chapter after chapter of Paul clarifying points and answering objections and introducing a new dimension to to the argument and so forth. And by the time you get to the end of chapter 8, there's just a sense of closure there. As if, he's finally finished what he had to say about this. But then, in chapters 9, 10, and 11, he raises a new topic. Not altogether unrelated to the earlier, but certainly distinct from it. Because Romans 1 through 8 is a sustained argument from point A to point Z, and all the points in between logically, seamlessly argued. But Romans 9 sort of turns a page and strikes out in another direction. And in these chapters, Romans 9 through 11, we have more theological discussion, but on a different topic, and that is the relationship of the gospel to God's promises in the Old Testament to the nation of Israel, or to the people of Israel. Because he has been saying in chapters 1 through 8 that there's no distinction between Jew and Gentile. The gospel is the same for all people. And at the end of chapter 8, he makes it clear that all things work together for good to those who love God and who are the called according to his purpose, and that nothing can separate us from the love of God. And yet, he anticipates that some of his readers are going to say, well, wait a minute, Paul. You say that all things work together for good to those who are God's called, but aren't the Jews God's called? Aren't the Jews God's chosen people? And look, most of them aren't saved. By your definition of salvation, their adherence to the law is doing them no good at all, and they're going to hell. How can this be? If they are the called and chosen ones, the Jewish people, then how can it be that they are not saved, as your gospel suggests, and that they are in large numbers on the road to damnation, when in fact you have said that all things work together for good to those who are called, according to God's purposes? And so Paul anticipating this, launches into an extended discussion of the relationship of Israel and God's promises to Israel to his gospel message and to Christ. And essentially, in Romans 9 through 11, what he argues is this, that God's promises to Israel have not failed to come true. They have, in fact, come true. God has fulfilled his promises to Israel, but we need to use correct definitions here. When God promised certain things to Israel, God was not using that term strictly in an ethnic sense. Because, as Paul points out in Romans 9, not everybody who is Jewish by birth really has ever been part of God's chosen people, God's Israel. Because, he points out, that even among Abraham's own children, only one out of the eight were chosen by God. Even though God said he'd bless Abraham's seed, yet Abraham had eight sons biologically, but only one was really part of the chosen. And that one was Isaac, and he had two sons, but not even both of them were of the chosen. Only one of those sons was chosen, that was Jacob. And what Paul is arguing there is that God's promises to Israel were never intended to be applied to every person who biologically could trace his ancestry to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but rather to a remnant, to the people of faith, the ones who are the children of the promise. And he goes on to argue that the children of the promise have in fact come in. They are called Christians now. The Jewish remnant has embraced Christ and has found the salvation that God promised to Israel, and they are the true Israel. And that the Jews who ultimately reject Christ, they never were part of the Israel, and they were not the ones to whom God made the promises. That God has indeed fulfilled his promises, but don't mistake what he means when he says Israel. And in fact, all Israel is being saved, and all Israel shall be saved, he says. But we must understand what we mean by Israel. Not all Jewish people certainly will be saved. In fact, Paul makes it clear by a quotation from Isaiah chapter 10. In Romans 9, he makes it clear that only a remnant of Jewish people will be ever saved. But all the true Israel will be saved. And that is Paul's discussion in Romans 9 through 11, which of course we will look at very closely when we come to that portion. So we've got the doctrinal and the practical sections. And the doctrinal is divided into two major sections. You've got chapters 1 through 8 presenting the general gospel information, and then Romans 9 through 11 specifically addressing the relationship of God's promises to Israel and Paul's message. And then when you get to the third section, which is Romans 12 through 15, we have, or through part of 15 anyway, we have Paul's practical instructions, almost all of which have to do with relationships. Relationships with the church, relationships with your enemies, relationships with the government, relationships with weaker brethren. And so one would get the impression that Paul thought all of the Christian life was relationships. Because once he gets around to applying the gospel in terms of how what we're supposed to do about it, how our life is supposed to be different, it's all in terms of our relationships with others. And so this is how the book of Romans is divided up. The latter portion of chapter 15 and all of chapter 16 don't really fall into the scope of the argument of the book, because in Romans 15, as we pointed out, I read some verses there a moment ago, Paul is talking about his travel plans and things like that, and then in chapter 16 he's simply greeting a lot of his friends by name. Now, before we really launch into our study of Romans proper, verse by verse, it's necessary that we acquaint ourselves with some of the vocabulary that Paul uses frequently in the book of Romans, because if you read a word and you think you know what it means, but it's not what Paul means, then you're going to misunderstand what he's saying, obviously. And there are certain words that are key words in the presentation of the message in Romans. Now, I've given you a list of some of them. Words like righteousness and justification. These are common words in the book of Romans. Words like grace and law, which is a contrasted words in the book of Romans. Faith and works, flesh and spirit. These are dichotomies that Paul makes much of in his discussion. And we might think we know what these words mean, and maybe we do, but we better make sure we do before we try to understand the the sentences in which they occur. So let me just briefly survey the meaning of these words, if we could. The word righteousness is really equivalent with the word justice. And it is maybe the key word of the book of Romans. Because when Paul actually gets over his initial introductions and greetings and so forth, and he gets around to his actual topic, he says in Romans 1:16 and 17, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it," that is in the gospel, "the righteousness of God is revealed." Okay? So the gospel is a revelation of the righteousness of God. He uses the same expression, the righteousness of God, in Romans 3:21. When he says, "But now the righteousness of God, apart from the law, is revealed." So in both places, Romans 1:17 and Romans 3:21, he says the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel. The only difference is that he adds a phrase in Romans 3:21, "apart from the law." But both statements are the same thing. The gospel is the manifestation, revelation of God's righteousness. But what is the righteousness of God? Now, the reason I pause to talk about this before getting into the book is because it's an ambiguous term. It is used two different ways. The term righteousness of God might mean, and does sometimes mean, God's own innate justice, God's own innate righteousness. To say God's righteousness is revealed could simply be saying it is revealed that God is right and just. That's what the righteousness of God could mean, God's own character trait of righteousness. And I believe that, in fact, it does mean that at one level and in some portions of the discussion. But at other times, the righteousness of God means the righteousness that is of or from God. The preposition of means from, derived from. And the righteousness from God, or the righteousness that God confers upon His people through faith, is also a meaning of the word the righteousness of God. It's not only that God Himself is righteous, but that we are made righteous by His action of so imputing us. He imputes us as righteous by faith. And therefore, we have a righteousness, but it's not of works. It's not even of ourselves at all. It is of God. It is from God. It is a gift of God, not of works. And so, when we encounter the expression, the righteousness of God, we need to discern whether Paul, in this place, is talking about God's own innate righteousness, which he possesses and which is a description of himself, or whether it's the righteousness that we possess, which is of him or from him. Not from ourselves. Both are aspects of the gospel that Paul preaches. The word justification is related to the word righteousness. Even as in English, the word justification is clearly related etymologically to the word justice or just. Justified means to be declared just or righteous. Now, it is not generally thought to be so in English, but in the Greek, we need to bear in mind that the word righteousness and justice are the same word in the Greek. And that the word righteous and just are the same word in the Greek. And when you find the word for justified, you're actually reading a word that's based on the same root as the word righteous. It is to be declared righteous or to be declared just. It is a legal term. We think of justification probably as a religious term because we hardly ever encounter it except in the Bible. Or when we do use it in common English outside of biblical contexts, we use it in a different sense than in a courtroom sense, because we say, oh, you're just trying to justify yourself. You know, when somebody's making excuses for what they did wrong, say, well, he's just rationalizing. He's just justifying his actions. And basically, that's a legitimate use of it. To say that someone's trying to justify himself means he's trying to declare that he's just. He didn't do the wrong thing. He's right. But he's justifying himself by excuses or rationalizations or whatever. In the Bible, it doesn't talk so much about man's self-justification, at least certainly doesn't speak positively of that, but it does speak positively of God's justifying sinners, meaning that God declares sinners to be righteous and just. And this term comes from the courtroom. When a person was accused of a crime and hailed before the court, there were two possible outcomes, just as there are today. If the police would break in here right now and haul one of you students off and say court date is set for 2 weeks from Monday, and they keep you in jail, and then you show up in court, and we all show up to figure out what's going on, we hear what the accusation is, there's two possibilities. When that court case is over, you will either be, as we would say today, we would say you were convicted of the crime, or you were acquitted. If you are convicted, it means it is the decision of the court that you are guilty. If you are acquitted, it means it is the conviction of the court that you are innocent, not guilty, just. Okay? Now, the word acquitted, as we use it in our modern court system, is the word that in Roman and Greek times was the word justified. Instead of saying an accused person was either convicted or acquitted, they would say he was either condemned or justified. It was a legal terminology. When Paul uses the word justified, he is speaking about God's legal case against sinners and how God goes about to let us off the hook without himself compromising his justice as a judge on the bench. What Paul establishes early on in Romans is that we're all sinners. We've broken God's laws. We're worthy of death. We're criminals. It's not as if we've simply been accused. We are guilty. And yet the judge really kind of pities us and wants us not to be guilty. He wants to somehow say, you're not guilty. I want to treat you like you're innocent. I want to be able to declare you are acquitted. But God has a problem here. He's got to be just. He can't pretend like people who are guilty are not guilty. Judges can't do that. Maybe parents can do that with their children. Maybe they can forgive their kids as if they haven't done anything. But judges aren't, that's not their job. The job of a judge is not to be pitiful or to be merciful. The job of the judge is to do justice. And God, in his role as the upholder of justice in his universe, must face this dilemma. How can he acquit persons that he desires to acquit, but who have no basis for acquittal? They are guilty. And this is how Paul, this is the question Paul answers. And he says finally, of course, after he goes through it all and lays out the basis for it, he says, therefore God justifies us. He acquits us. To be justified by faith means that we are acquitted because we believed. Now, why that would work is not immediately evident until we read Paul's discussion. I mean, it's not obvious why, if I'm really guilty of something, that I would somehow be declared not guilty because I believe certain things. You know, I mean, it's not obvious why that would be right. But Paul, that's what Paul argues. It takes about three chapters doing so and more to expound on it. So the word justified or justification has to do with the acquittal of an accused party. In this case, of a guilty accused party, the sinner. And yet God finds a way of justification. And Paul makes it clear that what God has done was ingenious. He found a way to himself be justified in justifying sinners. See, that's the problem. How does a judge say a guilty man is innocent and the judge retains his own integrity in saying so? How could he be a just judge? How could he be justified in doing so? And yet, after Paul has laid out his argument, here's how he puts it in Romans 3, 25 and 26, he says, whom God set forth to be a propitiation by his blood through faith to demonstrate his, that is God's, justice, his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, God had passed over the sins which were previously committed to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness. Once again, God's justice, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. How could God be just and justify the sinner who believes? Well, that's what Paul answers here. We won't talk right now about what his answer is in detail, but we can see that he's using the word justified here in the sense that we were describing. the conclusion Paul reaches in Romans 3:24 is that we are justified freely by his grace. He says, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Likewise, in Romans 5:1, he says, therefore, having been justified by faith. So, in Romans, he concludes that God has justified us by grace and by faith. Or as he puts it in Ephesians 2:8, by grace through faith. We'll see more of the details of that argument as we go through Romans. Let's talk about grace and law for a moment. This is a contrast that is found throughout the book of Romans. Grace is the Greek word charis, and charis literally means favor. To show favor. To think well of and to treat somebody well because you favor them. Now, God's favor, if it is based on works, cannot be extended to anybody because nobody has done enough good works for God to favor, to smile on their life. Everybody has sinned. Paul makes it clear, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Therefore, God cannot favor anyone if he were to do so on the basis of how they behaved. And if God is to favor anyone at all, it must be apart from their behavior. It must be unrelated to their behavior. It must be not connected with works they have done. It must be, by definition, unmerited by them because they can't merit his favor. His favor would require absolute perfection if it was based on behavior. And no one is perfect, and therefore no one could have his favor at all unless God dishes it out without merit, without reference to merit. And so Paul teaches in Romans 4, in verse 4, he said, now to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as a debt. But, he says, to him who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness. Now, in verse 4, he makes it clear. If the favor is, or the wages are given as a reward for behavior or works, then it's not really grace. It's a debt owed. And therefore, Paul uses the word grace in contrast with debt. The two are mutually exclusive. It can't be grace, it must be a debt. It can't be a debt, it must be grace. So what he's saying is that God favors us not out of any indebtedness on his part, but in spite of the fact that he doesn't owe it. It's unmerited. We have no innate claim upon it apart from God offering it freely. And yet, when there is grace received, it does change our behavior. Although God could never show us grace based on our previous behavior, nor even on our continuing behavior, yet once the grace has come to our life, it impacts our behavior. And Paul makes that clear in Romans 5 and 6. In Romans 5:21, he says, so that as sin reigned in death, even so grace might reign through righteousness. Now, when sin reigned in our lives, what did it do? It made us sin. Now grace reigns in the same sense. Sin once reigns there, but now grace does. And what's the result? Righteousness. Righteous conduct. And later in Romans 6, when he's anticipating someone will mistake what he means, in Romans 6:14, he says, for sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under the law, but under grace. And he says, what then? Shall we sin because we're not under the law, but under grace? People think that because you're under grace, you can get away with sin? That it doesn't have any impact on your behavior? And he goes on to say, no, absolutely not. In fact, if you are under grace, if you're under the rule of grace, it will prevent you from sinning. When you're under the rule of sin, you sin. When you're under the rule of grace, you do righteousness. You can't be under the rule of both, and you can't be under the rule of one and obey the other. The one you yield yourself to obey is the one whose master is yours. Or the one who is your master, I should say. You are the servant of the one you obey. You're either under sin and obeying sin, or you're under grace and obeying righteousness. Because grace reigns through righteousness. So Paul teaches that grace comes to us continuously through faith without reference to merit on our part or works on our part. However, it's not as if it doesn't have any impact on our moral life. It has tremendous impact. It results in righteousness in our life. The law, on the other hand, which is what many people think is necessary for living a good life and for seeking favor from God, doesn't have that impact at all. The law, in fact, has the opposite impact. If anything, it condemns, it does not justify. We'll read Paul's arguments on that when we come to the proper passages. But let me just say that Paul uses the word law a variety of ways in Romans, sometimes referring to the entire Old Testament. This is not a very common way to speak of the law, but it is found. In Romans chapter 3, verses 10 through 18, Romans 3, 10 through 18 actually rattles off in rapid succession several quotes from the Old Testament, most of them from the Psalms, one of them from Isaiah. And when he has done so, he summarizes them in verse 19 and calls them the law. He says, whatever the law says, he's referring to the verses he just quoted, the law. But what he's quoted are verses from Psalms and the prophets, not from what we technically would usually call the law. So clearly Paul is using the law here as a term that just means the whole Old Testament revelation, including the Psalms and the prophets. But more often the term law is used in contrast with the prophets and connected to them by the phrase the law and the prophets. The law being one part of the Old Testament, the prophets being a different part of the Old Testament. And this is a much more common use of the word law. This use of the word law reflects the Jewish word, the Torah. The Torah is the Hebrew word for law, and the Jews use it to describe the first five books of the Old Testament, the books of Moses. What Christians, using the Greek term, call the Pentateuch. The word Pentateuch is Greek for five books and refers to the books of Genesis through Deuteronomy at the beginning of the Old Testament. But the Jews call the same books the Torah, which is the law. And they understand their Bible, what we call the Old Testament. The Jews understand their Bible as divisible into three segments. The law and the prophets. And then there's a third group called the writings, and that would include the Psalms as the principal book, but also some of the other books that aren't technically law or prophets. And so the Jews have the law as a portion of their Old Testament, and that's going to be more often the way that Paul's going to use the term rather than just as the whole Old Testament. The term is ambiguous. He uses it different ways. The context must show exactly how he means it when he does use it that way. Also, very frequently, the term the law doesn't really refer to literature at all. It's not a reference to the Old Testament or even the five books of Moses. It's a reference rather to God's code of conduct. Of course, this is found written in those books, but to speak about the law often is not talking about the books that contain the written law, but rather the code itself, the rules themselves, the commands of God that the Jews would live under. The Jews would live their lives trying to obey these commands, and that's often what Paul means by the law, especially the Ten Commandments. And we'll find many references in Romans to the law used that way. And then rarely, but often enough to deserve our notice here, the word law is used in Romans sometimes the way we use it when we speak of a law of nature. If we talk about the laws of thermodynamics or the law of gravity, the laws of physics. We're not really talking about a moral code at all, or even rules that anyone's written that someone has to obey. The law of gravity is simply a description of the force of gravity, a description of the pattern of things governed by a certain principle. Laws of nature are not laws in the sense that we think of legislation. They are rather just principles of nature. And occasionally, in Romans, the word law is going to have the force of the meaning of the word principle rather than any of the other prior things mentioned. For example, in Romans chapter 3 and verse 27, Paul says, "Where is boasting then? It is excluded. By what law? The law of works? No, by the law of faith." What a strange expression, the law of faith. But here the word law means the principle. He says, "Where is boasting?" Well, boasting is excluded. On what principle? On the principles of works? No, boasting wouldn't be excluded on the principle of works. If we're saved by works, we could boast. Boasting is excluded on the principle of faith, because faith is not a work and faith isn't merit. And therefore, we can't boast on this principle. And so he's using the word law there as we would probably say, principle. He does the same thing, uses the term the same way in Romans 7. When he talks about the law of his mind and the law that's in his members conflicting with the law of his mind, like in Romans 7:21, I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. Or Romans 7:23, I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. This law is more like a force or a principle. As I say, very much like we would talk about the law of gravity. It's not something that somebody legislates and then we have to obey it like a rule. What it is simply a force that is observable. And there is a force or a principle in my flesh that inclines me to sin. There is a law or a principle that I've embraced with my mind that is toward holiness, but there's a conflict between these two forces. And so the word law, which is frequently used in the book of Romans, has different meanings in different contexts. We might as well be acquainted with that fact right away. Now, faith and works is another contrast in Paul's writings here. Faith is really just a wholehearted conviction and confidence in God. The epitome of this faith that justifies is found in Abraham and described by Paul in Romans 4, verses 19 through 22. Where he says that Abraham was not weak in faith, but he did not consider his own body already dead since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but he was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God and being fully convinced that what he had promised he was able to perform. Therefore it, that is his faith, was accounted to him for righteousness. What kind of faith? The kind of faith that was a total conviction in the veracity of God's promise. That governed his whole life. His life was changed and lived differently because he believed these promises. This is a life-changing conviction. Faith that saves is not just a general, disattached, disinterested belief that there's a God or that there's a Jesus or that he died for our sins and rose again. Even believing those facts isn't what saves. The devil believes those facts and he's not saved. And there's many people in America who believe those facts at a certain level and are not saved. Faith is a total compelling, life-changing, life-directing conviction in the veracity of God. It is the basis of justification. Paul says in both the Old and New Testaments, he quotes the Old Testament to prove this in the book of Romans. It is contrary to a mentality of earning righteousness by works, because it is simply by having this confidence in God that he justifies us, not because we do anything, not that we do any works to justify ourselves. It's a contrary to an idea of works righteousness. There is implied obedience. If you have this faith, it is implied in Scripture, and the faith itself suggests that this faith will compel obedience. Paul, for example, speaks in Romans 1:5 of the obedience to the faith. And he uses the same expression later on in chapter 16. He speaks of obedience to the faith in chapter 16, verse 26. He also uses the word faith in Romans 14 to speak of the confidence of having a clear conscience. He talks about whatever is not of faith is sin. And what he means by that is whatever you do that you don't have a clean conscience about is sin for you. So being able to do it by faith or having faith to eat meat sacrificed to idols, for example. If you've got the faith, fine. It's not sin for you. But if you don't have the faith, then it is, he says. And that means, of course, if your conscience is clear or not. So there's a special use of the word faith used in that passage in Romans 14, verse 1, and some of the other verses there. Works, on the other hand, can refer to works of the Jewish law, or alternately can simply refer to general good conduct, as, for example, in Romans 13:3, general good conduct is meant when he says the rulers are not a terror to good works. By good works, he means good conduct, good behavior generally. Law-abiding behavior, even abiding by the law of the land. But a lot of times, works means works of the Jewish law, or obeying the Jewish legal code. This is seen, for example, in Romans 9:32 and other places. Now, flesh and spirit are two other ideas that are contrasted. We can only give them a very brief treatment here. But Flesh is a term that in Scripture sometimes refers to human beings in general or the human race. When the Bible says in Genesis, all flesh had corrupted its way on the earth, or when it says no flesh would be saved, or all flesh is as grass, the word flesh there just means all humanity. Other times in Scripture, flesh means the physical body. In Romans 2:28, Paul says circumcision is not that which is in the flesh, meaning in the human body, as opposed to the other aspects of the human person. But also Paul uses the word flesh to speak of the condition of a person who's unregenerate. They're in the flesh. And Paul's use of the word flesh then means something like human nature, unregenerate human nature. When we were in the flesh, we could not obey or please God, he says. But now we're not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, which introduces the contrast. Spirit. Being in the Spirit, when Paul uses it, or in the flesh, is not how we might use it. We might speak of someone being in the flesh or in the Spirit, meaning they're behaving in a way that's fleshly or behaving in a way that's spiritual, respectively. But when Paul uses these terms, it means either that a person is regenerate or unregenerate. The person who is born again is in the Spirit. It has nothing to do with how they're behaving at the moment or whether they're in a spiritual mindset. It has to do with an objective state. The Spirit of God is in the believer, and that believer is thus in the Spirit. Just like we could say that a person is in Christ and Christ is in him. If Christ is in you, you're in Christ. If the Spirit of God is in you, you're in the Spirit, says Paul in Romans chapter 8. And so we need to be aware that Paul uses those terms a little differently than we might be familiar with. The Spirit usually means the Holy Spirit. Sometimes the Spirit can mean the human spirit, the spiritual side of man as opposed to his body or his flesh, the inner man as opposed to the outer man. Spirit can even refer to an attitude, as when it says God has not given us a spirit of fear or a spirit of bondage again to fear in Romans 8. But the term in the Spirit simply means possessing the Spirit and being in Christ, being a Christian as opposed to a non-Christian. So these are the main words that we need to have some orientation to before we get into Romans. Next time we'll come back and actually begin our exploration of the first chapter.